Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. And after discussing 1967's How I Won the War last week, now seems like the perfect time to talk about 2013's Living is Easy with Eyes Closed, or, in the original Spanish title,
Vivir es fácil con los ojos cerrados.
It's a Spanish language film about a teacher and Beatles fanatic Antonio, who uses the group's lyrics to teach English to his pupils. The film follows as he and two younger hitchhikers take a road trip to Almeria to visit the set of, you guessed it, How I Won the War, in the hopes that he will meet his hero John Lennon. The film was Spain's official contender for that year's Oscars, and despite being overlooked for selection, swept the Goya Awards in 2014, which are the Spanish equivalent of the Oscars. But what did we think of the film? Did it pass our strict criteria for cinematic quality, or will we have to defer to the Spanish equivalent of us? Let's find out. So, to kick things off, the film starts with a newsreel that sets the scene around what the Beatles are up to at that point in their career, and obviously specifically where John Lennon is at. So how does that relate to setting the tone for the film and what the film covers?
Well, so this is a point in the Beatles' career where they've just stopped touring. They've just played their last gig to a paying audience in San Francisco. So I'm not sure they necessarily know at this point that they're definitely never going to tour again, but certainly they are at the very least taking an extended break. They all kind of choose to fill their time in slightly different ways. John accepts an offer to go off and shoot this film, How I Won the War, directed by Richard Lester, director of Hard Day's Night and Help. There's obviously a lot more discussion about How I Won the War in that episode, but the main significance of John's time in Spain, as far as Beatles fans are concerned, is that that is where he wrote Strawberry Fields Forever. And so that is... That's kind of the theme that's running through the film. You know, there are visual references to it with strawberries throughout, which, you know, I'm sure we'll get to later. But Antonio, the main character, who's the English teacher, he's a Beatles fanatic and he's using Beatles lyrics to teach English to his pupils. And he decides he wants to go off and meet John Lennon because he has lyrics that he can't quite decipher. And at this point, the Beatles lyrics are not printed on the record sleeves. So he decides he wants to go off and like ask John to help him like complete some of the lyrics in his notebook.
So I would like to ask you a quick question on this, almost as a side note, because I think we will go on to talk about why the film. I think we both agree that the film is pretty great, and it's a really nice sort of understated character piece, I think, and we can dig into that a little bit more. But just before we get into that, teaching English to kids via Beatles lyrics.
Yep.
How robust as an educational tool is that?
Well, I mean, obviously you've not read the national curriculum as stringently as I have, but I've actually got a bit of useful context on this as well. I asked my Spanish friend Juan about this film. I told him I'd seen it. I told him we were going to be discussing it. And I asked him for a bit of context about Spain in the 1960s under Franco. And he sent me a voice note. So what you're about to hear is a WhatsApp voice note recording, I think, while he was standing in the street. So it doesn't sound fantastic, but I think the context he gives, particularly about the use of the Beatles to teach English in schools, is actually really insightful.
Basically, the 60s, Spain is starting to open to the world. Basically, we were already like 30 years, something like that, with Franco in the power, because I mean, the Civil War finished in the 39. So it was like 20 something years during the 60s. And basically, I remember that, for example, my mother, I told you that they used to learn French in school, okay? But I think at that time, it was already coming like the English as the, because of the United States, like the language that they were meant to learn. And for example, in school, they were playing the Beatles to learn English. Because I remember my mother showed me the Beatles when I was a kid. She was the one that introduced me to the Beatles because she used to listen to it in class. Basically, Spain is opening to the world a little bit. This comes with the also the wave of the hippie power. The people start rebel trends start happening, you know, and they will finish like in the 70s with the end of the dictatorship. So still, it was quite close country, but they were opening a bit.
I think there is probably something in that about how the Beatles are kind of in the same way that English is about a universal language, but certainly it's one of the more widely spoken languages in the world. You do find that most European countries you go to, they tend to speak fantastic English when they've never been to England and had no reason to. The Beatles being one of Britain's sort of biggest cultural exports to the rest of the world, I think these things do end up sort of bleeding themselves into other people's national, other countries' national cultures. And language is a big part of that. You know, you hear a lot about, kids, you know, a sort of Portuguese 3-year-old will sort of know the words to Yellow Submarine, won't necessarily know what they mean, but will know the sound of them at the very least.
It's a really good point, actually. And it's another example of how the Beatles' influence probably reaches further than we give it credit for, because that's the kind of detail that just becomes sort of naturally, almost like by osmosis, becomes part of sort of the history around the world without us really calling out that that's how it's happened. I did think that when the film starts, obviously the film begins with one of those English lessons, and it's Antonio teaching his kids English through the use of the lyrics in Help. And I think that's obviously a significant song for the film, for the script to start with. I will admit that as soon as that started, I was thinking about what other songs has he taught his kids, and are there any that would be inappropriate to do so?
Like,
has at any point he made a Spanish kid stand up and have to repeat verbatim, "I'd rather see you dead, little girl," you know, like at that time. Yeah, and obviously Michelle is problematic in itself, right? If you're going to try and teach English to kids.
Well, absolutely. Also, I mean, he'll be, he's a few years off having to teach Sun King with its like gibberish Spanish. Like, it's kind of Espanol, isn't it? Or something like that.
But yes, that's right.
It doesn't even make sense.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, of course. I mean, I was thinking as well, I mean, can you imagine? So the film ends, like, you know, without getting too much into spoiler alert, the film ends with the notion that the Beatles then started to include lyrics on their albums in order to help this kind of thing. And I can only imagine that Antonio's kids would pick up a copy of that album and be like, tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Thanks, sir. Like, how is this helpful?
Yeah.
By the time they get onto like Goo Goo Gajoob, like it's, I'm not really sure how much he's helped there. But yeah, I just think it was a, I couldn't help but think as an actual tool of the national curriculum, maybe there are some flaws that would need to be overcome.
Maybe. Yeah.
But Help is a significant choice of song, obviously, to start the film off with.
Yeah.
I'll admit now that I watched this film twice, and I don't think it was until the second viewing that I was able to realise the significance of choosing that song to begin with.
Yeah.
I think it's plain that that would have significance, but the idea behind what thematically is happening in the film, it's a little bit buried beneath the surface of the narrative.
Yeah, I mean, Help is kind of, as I say, like Strawberry Fields is kind of a theme throughout, but Help is just as strongly a theme throughout. So they're singing this in the car later on, towards the end of the film. Antonio talks about, you know, Help and its significance. Significant also in that, as I think he says at some point in it, or at least alludes to, Help is probably, like, lyrically, probably the first sign that John Lennon is not okay.
Antonio does make the point, I think, in the classroom scene that, like, he's challenging his pupils to as to why John Lennon might need help. You know, he's saying, like, you know, he's really famous and he's sings this to thousands. Why would he be singing about Help? I think one of the kids turns around and says, "Help with him spending all of his money." You know, as a sort of a, you know, a fun thing. But it's interesting that I think the film sets out this idea already of just looking a little bit deeper beneath the surface of what's actually happening. And, you know, in the same way that he is challenging his pupils to look beyond what they see in terms of John Lennon, I guess that's kind of true of the film, in the sense that at no point does the film explicitly say these are the three characters that we're focused on are in a particular situation with which they need help to get out of.
Yeah.
But you kind of understand that if you think a little bit harder about it from watching the film.
Yeah. I think they're all, yes, they all need help, not necessarily in obvious ways. Some in quite minor ways, you could argue, like Juanjo, who's the younger sort of teenage boy, I'm going to say he's probably about 15 or something like that, is basically just having the same conversation with his strict father that lots of boys are having in the mid-60s, which is, when are you going to get your hair cut? And having lots of people tell him, like, he's got long hair, he looks like a girl. You know, and of course, it's one of those haircuts that, like it would be absolutely fine for someone to just work in an office today with that haircut. Yes. Like you'd think,
I like, that's your benchmark, like, just working in an office.
Yes.
Like, it's funny, isn't it? Because obviously, true superiors, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But there is a part of me watching that film being like, his hair is fine.
Yeah.
Because I'm approaching it from a bit of a modern sensibility, right?
No,
but
of course.
Like, why does everyone think he looks like a girl? Obviously, he looks absolutely fine.
If anything, of course,
he looks quite cool.
Yeah, anything that wasn't a short back and sides is the thing. You know, but then there's a parallel there, because obviously, like, How I Won the War is the film that John Lennon cut his hair for. And that was a big thing in the press at the time. Again, we talk about this more in the How I Won the War episode, but it was a big deal that he had cut his hair. It was kind of like symbolic of, like, oh, is this the end of this movement or something like that, you know?
And cutting hair is not just with Juanjo, it's all the way through, isn't it? It feels like it's a recurring motif, because you have you know, the reason he runs away from home to begin with is obviously because of his sort of overbearing and, by all impressions, aggressive father.
Yeah.
But that comes to a head with him being told that he has to have his hair cut when he doesn't want to.
Yeah.
Then there is the bully in Almeria that actually cuts his hair.
Yeah.
And does that against his own will, which is like a real sort of, you know, tragic moment in the film.
Yeah.
But also later on, when Hanko makes Belen, the other hitchhiker, helps her, I take on the role within the movie production of How I Won the War. It's only a brief scene, but gets her a place in cutting the extras' hair to look more sort of period appropriate.
Yeah,
and it's funny, because you're right. It's this sort of symbolic of change, which I think is which is just really key to the film in lots and lots of different ways. It keeps coming up in different motifs, but this idea of cutting hair and this sort of signifying a new step forward does sort of keep coming back.
Yeah, in the film. Almost like the shedding of a skin or something.
Yes,
like
exactly.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the idea that that change is kind of in the air is sort of significant here, I suppose. So this is, you know, to set it in context, this is in Franco's Spain. Now, I'm not an expert on this by any stretch of the imagination, but this is an authoritarian regime. It is perhaps it has its roots in fascism, if perhaps not. Not sort of full-blown fascism. Fascism light, if you will. You know.
Or in the same way that you'd have like a Coke light.
Yeah, exactly.
A Bud Light.
Of course, yeah, exactly.
Okay, good. It's the Bud Light of regimes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
okay.
And so it's not like people are sort of in concentration camps or anything, but what is happening is there's certainly a lot of restrictions on freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, protest, things like that. This is a single-party state. For sure, and a sort of cult of personality under Franco, whereby he is people are sort of encouraged to think of him almost as a god, is my understanding. And so the characters are kind of referring a little bit throughout the film to this, if not overtly. I mean, so you do see the fact that what seems like military police are sort of all over the place and seem to be, you know, feared. You know, when Antonio picks up Belen the first time, he gets her to sort of duck down in the car so that the military police don't see her. And there's a Catalan character as well, and sort of Catalan culture and practices were very much restricted back then. So there are people there who they're able to live their lives and go about their business, but with certain restrictions. Mm. And so I think the older generation there have sort of grown up in the Spanish Civil War and sort of have their memories of that. And the younger people, as is always the case in situations like this, the younger people are the ones who are sort of agitating for change or don't understand why things have to be this way. And so, of course, as in so many of these things in youth culture around that time, the Beatles fit into this so well because they're the sort of perfect symbol of freedom of expression anywhere in the world where, you know, even sort of behind the Iron Curtain at this time, people were sort of smuggling in Beatles records. Mm. It was sort of, you know, contraband because, you know, they were seen as a, you know, without necessarily by that point being a sort of, you know, singing any protest songs themselves. Authoritarian regimes were well aware of the lack of control and potential for civil unrest when the Beatles come into town, all the screaming that goes on, you know, what does this mean? How do we control this? You know, and the answer is you probably can't. I think they played in Spain a couple of times. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, I looked this up. Right. Yes, it's they played in Madrid on the 2nd of July 1965, and played in Barcelona the day after that.
Right, okay.
They arrived in Madrid the day before on the 1st of July.
Right.
65, which I think is where a lot of that footage from the newsreel at the start of the film comes from.
Right, yeah.
It's them, yeah, seemingly being photographed during their day in Spain.
Yeah, and I think they're being photographed maybe with sort of matadors and things like that. And just
there's a little bit of that, yeah. There's
wearing the hats maybe.
There's definitely a moment where you see John trying to pour some like Spanish sherry from a particular receptacle that's famous in Spain.
And
it's almost like a day of tourism, like press tourism, like it's a press event, right? They would obviously had like press surrounding them, taking photos of them, doing all of this stuff,
right? Yeah,
as they experienced the country like a normal person, but obviously not.
yeah, they weren't necessarily walking around like putting on the matador hats.
No, exactly.
Just happened to take
checking
their
the
picture.
Map every now and again. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it strikes me that when put into those terms, and again, I cannot stress enough that the film obviously doesn't explicitly call out these circumstances.
Yeah.
But when put into those terms, with the regime that the characters are currently experiencing, and this need for or the idea that they're on the cusp of a sort of systematic change,
yeah,
it seems almost perfect that this ties in with the song Strawberry Fields Forever out of any song. So it feels almost like the writer-director David Truba has found in what is apparently a true story a through line that really makes a lot of thematic sense. And that feels like quite a significant coincidence at the time. But what a great way to sort of mirror that change with this particular song choice.
Yeah, that, you're right. It does feel like Strawberry Fields. So Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane as a double A side. So that's the first thing that was recorded for the Sgt. Pepper sessions and then released as a double A side single while they were working on Sgt. Pepper, which was released in what, May 67? So yeah, this maybe came out a couple of months before, I forget exactly when. But I think certainly, other than the fact that they'd done Tomorrow Never Knows at the end of Revolver, which obviously is a pretty obvious symbol of where this is all going. But I would say it's the first sort of psychedelic song, if you like, or it feels like the first one of that era. And it is ushering in change for sure. I think it's sort of ironic in a way that Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane are both concerned with nostalgia, even though they're sort of so kind of forward thinking musically. And it's the strange irony of these sort of 25-year-olds writing nostalgic songs about their childhood,
yeah,
which were not very long ago.
It's like
all,
a dagger to the heart for me. It's like, what have you got to be nostalgic about?
Yeah,
ridiculous. But and also in some ways, it's quite a neat little follow up to Help as well. I often think this in terms of like Help is often cited as, well, actually both songs are often cited as signifiers for John suddenly starting to write about himself in a very introspective way.
Yeah.
So to help start the film and then for Strawberry Fields to be the focus of the film feels like there's sort of a connection between the two that's being made quite explicit that we probably don't think about very much these days.
Yeah.
I think for Strawberry Fields Forever, part of that introspection comes out of him being without the guys for the first time. Right. So, and by all accounts, he was on set bored a lot of the time, yeah, and without having that release of having his bandmates around him to sort of help alleviate that boredom.
Yeah.
So that was the start of him suddenly writing very personally about himself.
Yeah, it does seem that way, doesn't it? I suppose it seems like he, although, you know, he was already in the habit of spending a lot of time at home at Kenwood, not doing much. So, you know, it's like he was sort of able to indulge his passion, if you like, for being lazy, you know. I think in Almeria, so Cynthia was out there. Ringo came out to visit a little bit, I think, for a few days. Mal Evans as well, I think, maybe. Uh-huh. Was there a little bit. But yeah, it seems like he had a lot of... because, film sets, all actors say one of the things about film sets is there is so much waiting around.
Yeah.
I think you very quickly get over the supposed glamour of it and realise like just how much it is of just having to get to this place at 6 a.m. and then they've got nothing for you to do until midday.
Yeah.
You have to be there anyway, you know. I'm sure John, being the kind of guy he was, might have got quite frustrated with that quite quickly. It may have been that Dick Lester managed him in a certain way. I can imagine that he probably would have done.
Yeah.
And sort of, you know, made sure he wasn't too bored. But yeah, he had a lot of time to be introspective and to write that song, which apparently I think he wrote on a sort of classical guitar or a Spanish guitar that he'd found quite cheap somewhere, I think.
You mentioned earlier as well that there is some visual imagery that sort of chimes with Strawberry Fields, in that strawberries are everywhere in this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
I do think that the film kind of implies that is how the song gets its title. if I'm right in this, I don't think the Strawberry Fields part... So obviously Strawberry Fields Forever gets its name primarily from Strawberry Field, which is the Salvation Army near where John lived when he was a child. I think I'm right in thinking that at this point in time, you know, in the time frame that the film depicts, John hadn't actually brought in the Strawberry Field elements to that song yet. Yeah. He had the other lyrics in place, but not that part of it.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But the film does kind of imply, oh, look, there are Strawberry Fields everywhere. So obviously, that's, you know, that's what the song is about. Kind of ignoring this sort of well-known fact about what the song and where that title actually comes from.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've spoken about this a few times where the films often have this tendency to just sort of imply the inspiration for lyrics, but usually it's much clumsier. Usually it's this thing of like someone saying a thing in a sentence,
yes,
you know, and the character going,
Yeah, it'll be someone coming up to John Lennon explicitly and saying, "Cool, have you seen the size of this strawberry field? It looks like it goes on forever." You know, it'll be something really lame like that.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and the main claim, if you like, the film is kind of making is, we should say, by the way, that this the character of Antonio, the teacher, is based on a real guy, like a guy called Juan Carrion, who was an English teacher who did this. He traveled to the set to meet John. I don't think the bit about him picking up hitchhikers is true, but I think the rest of it is broadly pretty accurate. He did get to meet John. John did correct the lyrics, the Revolver lyrics that he'd written in his notebook. The character Antonio says that the Beatles have a nasty habit of not printing their lyrics in their record sleeves, which is like a strange thing to say because no one ever printed lyrics in record sleeves.
No. So famously, Sergeant Pepper's was the first one that did that, right?
Right. So the caption over the end credits says, after this this meeting, every Beatles album from this point onwards had the lyrics printed on the record sleeve, which is not true.
It's just factually incorrect.
But yeah, Sergeant Pepper was the first album ever to have the lyrics printed in the sleeve. So it is quite carefully phrased in a way that it is a correlation, not necessarily causation, i.e. Yeah. It's saying that this thing happened, and then after it, this thing happened.
Yes,
opposed to this thing definitely caused this thing to happen.
Because that's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because I think that my understanding of the Sergeant Pepper album is, and one of the reasons why it's cited so often as the greatest album of all time is because when it was released, it was, you know, it was a deluxe version of the album before we even knew what deluxe versions of the album were. So it was, you know, it was, rather than the usual 12-inch vinyl and sleeve, it was a full gatefold with lyrics and cut out characters of the Beatles in uniform. And it felt like a little bit more like a bumper pack for the album that came with it.
Yeah.
I guess I've always held the view that this was just a canny piece of commercial thinking, possibly even from the Beatles themselves, possibly even from Paul, purely because he's always seemed to be the most commercially minded one and a person who wants to sort of push those boundaries in that way. It's interesting that this film directly implies, like you say, it's an implication, not explicitly said, that is why the lyrics were printed in the album, as opposed to it being part of this sort of fuller rounded idea of how they should release a big event record.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, so the idea, I suppose, is that the influence John has had on this guy has like changed his life, but also like he's changed John's life in a way. So I mean, I think it's worth saying that the way the film depicts John as a character is, you never, there isn't really an actor playing John. You see him from a distance. At the end, Antonio manages to get onto the set, and he goes into John's caravan. John opens the door and greets him. You see him in the distance in a way that it's identifiably him, in a way that is done really well.
Like, yeah, very well, yeah.
You know,
there's a very good long distance, identifiably how I won the war era haircut for John.
Yeah.
It's the only way I can describe that.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
But from the distance at which the camera is shooting that moment and that character, whoever that's standing in is looks identical to how you imagine John to look at that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, he's holding a guitar, which helps as well.
Always. Actually, you probably didn't need to waste their time on their haircut.
Yeah.
The guitar does the trick.
And so the way it is done is that John is kind of this remote figure. And so while he's in the caravan, we stay with Juanjo and Belén, and the scene you describe about the cut where she gets involved in cutting the extra's hair. That's what we get at that point while Antonio is in the caravan with John. So we never see Antonio in the caravan with John, which is a really, really good creative decision, I think.
Yeah.
I think having an actor playing John in that would be quite disappointing. And I think also it would remove the mystique, because this is kind of like The Wizard of Oz, right? You know, it's a sort of road movie in which they're sort of going off to meet this mystical character who can help them in some way.
Yeah.
And you know, of course, in The Wizard of Oz, the reveal that it's actually just some guy behind a curtain is for the characters very unsatisfying, you know. And I think it's so much better just to keep this guy as that, just like a figure, kind of like the mystique is maintained by not having an actor play him in a serious way.
I completely agree, and I think that it's a better creative choice to have that happen. Having recently read an interview with the writer-director David Treba, which would have been published at the time of the film's release, I do think it's a shame that one detail gets left out of the film as a result of that. And in this interview, Treba says, because this is based on a true story and the teacher does exist, that notebook exists as well, in terms, you know, detailing the lyrics and Lennon's then corrections that he made in that notebook. And Treba says in this interview that the funny thing is about that is that Lennon used different colours when correcting the lyrics. So for Yellow Submarine, he used a yellow pen, and if he wrote the word green, he would use a green pen. And you'd only have to look at the way he did those corrections to know that he was a really funny guy.
Mm.
And I just think that's a really cool detail to know about John. Like, that's something that, you know, obviously never heard of before. You probably would never know without the context of this story and this chance meeting. Mm. But what a funny, like, thing that John did. He couldn't even correct a notebook without doing it in a funny way, you know?
Yeah, it's a nice detail.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And so, like, what Antonio goes away with is a tape recording of John. So I think what he's asked him for is like a message for his pupils. And I think maybe in the film, Antonio comes away with the impression that John has agreed to come to his school and meet his pupils. Whether he's got that right or not, we're not completely sure. So he later gives this as a gift to Juanjo, and it is a recording of John playing a demo of Strawberry Fields Forever.
This is for your class. I hope they like it.
Living is easy with eyes closed, misunderstanding all you see. It's getting hard to be someone, but it all works out. It doesn't matter much to me.
You know, so like Juanjo basically has like the greatest Beatles bootleg that there is.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that kid would be like a millionaire now, you know. In fact, I mean, we have to ask, I mean, is this fictional bootleg of Strawberry Fields Forever Peter Jackson's next project?
It would be remiss of us not to bring up in this episode, like I do every episode, Peter Jackson's future plans.
Yeah, exactly. But that's done really well. So it's played at the end. Juanjo's father turns up to take him home, which he does sort of quite uncomplainingly, and sort of Belén comes along with them for the ride. I think the implication is she's going to come to Madrid with them, and there's a job in a hairdresser's she can get there. So Juanjo plays this in the car through the tape recorder.
And I will stop you and just quickly interrupt and say, when I heard this recording, my immediate thought was, you know, it's a brilliant John Lennon recording, yeah, of him playing this song on an acoustic guitar. This has to be one of the takes that are available on the anthology or the Sgt. Pepper's Deluxe album with all the many different versions of that song that are on those records.
Yeah.
So I immediately went to try to track down which version that was. It's not any of those, is it?
No. No. But it's great. I mean, but it sounds so authentic.
Yeah.
So what it is, it's Neil Harrison, who was one of the founding members of the Bootleg Beatles and was John in the Bootleg Beatles right up until, I think, about 2010. So a year or two before this film came out was his last appearance as John. And what he's doing really is sort of recreating the acoustic demo version of Strawberry Fields that you hear on the anthology, on Anthology 2, I think it is.
Yeah.
And he does an excellent job. It's really haunting. And so this is played, they're sort of mainly driving in silence right at the end of the film, other than a couple of times his father says something like, "Oh, so this is the music people listen to these days, is it?" Or something, yeah, like that, you know.
Which again, I think is a nice point to end on, because that is again pointing to this sort of oncoming change with a new generation coming up. You know, this is calling out that this is what young people listen to nowadays. Automatically brings to mind this idea of a generational shift.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a bit sort of slightly earlier on where sort of Antonio is talking about what the Beatles songs mean to him. And I think he's talking more broadly about what Beatles songs meant to that generation. And by the, I mean, we should say as well that Antonio is a slightly sort of imperfect spokesman for that generation, because he's not quite of that generation. I'm going to say he's probably about 40 or something like that.
Yeah, but one of the things that's so charming about that character is that he always seems to have that generation's best interests at heart.
Yeah, definitely.
And there are moments in the film where he puts aside his own interests in order to focus on a younger generation.
Yeah.
So there is a great scene actually where I'm going way off topic. Let's take a massive detour just to focus on this point a little bit. But there's a great scene after Antonio gets drunk.
Yeah.
And in a sort of charming way, propositions Belen and says that he would marry her if she wanted, and then goes back to his own room in a sort of gentlemanly manner.
Yeah.
She then has a sexual encounter with Juanjo.
Yeah.
And the next day, as a viewer, I think you expect some kind of tension between the three, because there's now a triangle, love triangle between, you know, and you wonder how that's going to play out.
Yeah.
Up until what has at that point been quite an amicable relationship between the three of them.
Yeah.
What Antonio and Juanjo discover is that Belen has left.
Yeah.
They go and find her, and Juanjo immediately goes to speak to her. And there's an expression on Antonio's face where he seems to understand that there is a deeper relationship happening between the two of them that he's not part of.
Yeah, yeah.
And as he's watching that scene play out, where presumably Juanjo is trying to convince Belen to rejoin them as a group, a boy comes up and tries to sell some fruit to him.
Yeah.
And he immediately just changes his focus and talks to that boy in a sort of friendly manner. And, there are lots of scenes like that where there is something that he is setting out to do in his own interests, but actually he puts that all aside to engage with younger, and it's just with the younger generation. And I think it's indicative of him as a character that is what he's interested in doing. And that's one of the reasons why I think he's, you know, he comes across as just a lovely chap.
Yeah, in the whole definitely. Film. Yeah, yeah. I mean, so, you know, let's say he's 40, and I suppose Belen is probably about 16 or something like that. She's pregnant, by the way. That's her, and she was in what seems like a sort of convent home for like pregnant girls.
They explain that it's a place for her to stay until she gives birth, and at that point she can decide whether or not they will then take on her child for adoption.
Yeah, that's right.
So, but there is, it's also heavily implied early on in the film that the women that go through that process end up often regretting that and ended up in quite sort of tragic circumstances, separated from their child.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the scene you describe where Antonio sort of kind of propositions her. So, I mean, given the age difference between them, that feels like it should be like incredibly inappropriate and change the way you think about him completely. Because, you know, obviously there could be a darkness to this story, you know, like a man picking up two teenage hitchhikers, you know.
But that's also foreshadowed in the film, because just before Belen meets Antonio, there is a guy who does exactly that and sort of, you know, touches her in an inappropriate way and tries to keep her with him. And he looks a similar age and build to Antonio.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. But actually, the way that scene plays out, where he doesn't really seem like he's seriously propositioning her. I think, you know, he just sort of says, like, you know, can I kiss you? And she says yes, like, you know, in an uncomplicated way. And he just kind of kisses her on the cheek, and that's kind of it. And it's much like there's an affection there, but it didn't seem to me that it was even a sexual thing.
No, sorry, yeah, and maybe I should have made that clear as well. So this, but it does feel like the relationship between the characters is evolving in a way that even they themselves aren't sure of yet.
Yeah.
And therefore, when we get to that morning after, I think there are a few questions that seem to be hanging in the balance there around how they all feel about each other and what that means going forward.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think ultimately that gets resolved from Antonio realizing that I think he seems to be comfortable with the fact that he can take a step back and realize that actually the future is in the hands of the younger generation almost. You know, he's happy to, or he accepts that actually some of the decisions going forward actually aren't his place to be a part of.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I say, I mean, potentially, this is a story that could have a much darker tone, but doesn't. It chooses not to. So, I mean, certainly, as we say, like he's an obsessive fan, if you like, in that he has lots of sort of fixed opinions about the Beatles and their importance. But he's sort of older, so he's sort of atypical of Beatles fans at that time. But he also appears to have this kind of slightly parasocial relationship with John, i.e. the idea that, so there's a bit where he's talking about how when they played in Madrid, they're talking about how are you going to get onto this film set? They'll have security. And he says, well, I mean, John wouldn't want all that security. You know, when they played in Madrid, he hated all the fact that all the best seats were taken by the VIPs and things like that. So he kind of seems to almost have taken on John's ideology, or sort of imagine himself to know him more deeply than he does, you know. And of course, you know, that tragically is how John's life ended, by a person who imagined himself to have that relationship with John and felt kind of spurned when John, who he'd never met, behaved in a way that he didn't want him to, you know.
Yeah.
That's a gross simplification of Mark Chapman and the reasons for him murdering John, but you know, that's kind of part of it. And so I think this could be a film about a mad fan. It could be a film about a guy who sort of picks up hitchhikers on the way and kills them, you know.
Yeah.
It's not just, I mean, obviously, like those choices would have made it a completely different film. But what I mean is that there could be a lot more darkness in the character. And I think it's actually in the way that Javier Camara kind of plays him, actually. Because I think there are probably little character choices he could make in there. I mean, he could have played that scene where he propositions Belen like very, very differently.
Yeah, I agree.
And made the tone completely different, you know.
There were loads of great character moments like that he's contributing to throughout the film. I really like, there's a scene early on where there's a sort of a recurring question that runs through the film where he is asking Belen and Hanko what they think his pupils call him as a nickname.
Yeah.
And I love this scene in the car where Belen is looking at him up and down and saying, Baldy? Like, fatty?
yeah.
Like, and rather than take actual offence at that, like, he really takes it on the chin and sort of laughs with it. Like, and this is very early on in them establishing a relationship between the two of them.
Yeah.
It could have gone either way, and they were just, he just seems so amiable as a character that it's just impossible not to like it. And because you have such a likeable character who is the main person that is going on this quest to meet John Lennon, you really get behind that as a story. You really root for him no matter what happens along the way.
Yeah.
And the film really is just a series of character moments.
Yeah.
You know, like, there is very little in the way of, you know, there is progress made in meeting John, but it kind of happens almost in the background to what is happening at the forefront around how these characters are getting to know each other and sort of, you know, what happens to them on the way to get into Almeria and when they get there.
Right, yeah. Maybe the real Strawberry Field is the friends we made along the way.
Exactly.
But actually, like, you think about how road movies are usually structured, and there tends to be more... there tends to be more obstacles put in the way, i.e. they're trying to get to this place in order to achieve this thing. So, like, was that like teen comedy Road Trip, right?
Yes.
Midnight Run or something like that, you know, where, you know, they've got to get from A to B, planes, trains and automobiles, got to get from A to B, and they constantly all of these obstacles are put in their way and they have to overcome them. This is not that, really, in that. So obstacles are in the way, but not huge ones. So really what happens is, like, when they first get to the film set, there are some guards there who say, no, you can't come in. Not unreasonably. And he doesn't seem to have... He didn't particularly have much of a plan B there. But they do manage to... How do they do it? So they go to the cinema where there's...
They go to a preview screening of the film of How I Won the War.
Oh, it's like the Daily Rushes, isn't it?
Do to sneak into that is go to see the film that is shown before they do that and hide in the cinema after the film ends so that they're still there when the crew come in.
Yeah.
And it's a really nice scene, actually, and there's a really nice shot of them in the cinema, and you can see John Lennon in the movie How I Won the War on the big screen in the background. And it's really nicely framed and colourised, and it just looks quite stunning.
Yes, yeah.
When that happens.
Yeah, and actually, I think that also kind of feeds into that thing of him being this sort of a strange, untouchable figure, or just being ever so slightly out of reach all the time.
Yeah, and he is. Yeah, going back to your thing about the obstacles, you're absolutely right, because in any road trip movie, there would be things that happen along the way that they then have to overcome to continue their progress, and those things do happen.
Yeah,
but they end up being quite easily resolved because it's not that film.
Yeah, like, it's not
so
the point of
the
it,
car breaks down.
Yeah,
they end up just pushing it a bit until they get to a downhill and they jump back in again and it starts again, you know. When they get to the perimeter of the film set, they don't have to try and sneak past or anything like that. They just find a way to meet a contact and get invited in.
Yeah,
you know, like, it's all resolved very, you know, in a sort of nice way.
Yeah,
in some ways I'll go so far as to say that the film was written to deliberately subvert those kind of road trip tropes.
Yeah, exactly. So it's much more, as you say, like, this film is like completely full of character moments, and that's because the what seems like the deliberate absence of that usual road movie structure leaves room for characterization instead.
Yeah.
Like, the thing itself, the satisfaction of the whole film is in that characterization and not in the you know, the various tropes of the road movie as you'd usually expect it.
Yeah. I think one of the great things, again, about Strawberry Fields Forever being the song that's really in question in the film is, and also a focus on Beatles lyrics generally, is that we have this lion living his easy with eyes closed being called out in the film itself, and obviously is the film's title. And actually it's a really nice moment where the very last thing you see in the film, played mid-credits, is Antonio back in his classroom with that lion written on the chalkboard.
Yeah.
As, you know, like, well, how great is that? Like, you get this real sense of, like, oh, you've been teaching your kids Beatles lyrics to help them read English, and you've got, like, a preview of one that's not even out yet.
Yeah,
a great like triumphant moment for him as a teacher to be like, now let's talk about this.
Yeah.
But let's talk about that because because it's not help I need somebody, is it? Like living is easy with eyes closed. Like what would the discussion be that Antonio would have with his kids around what that means to them? But I guess the question I wanted to ask you was, why do we think the film has lifted that particular lyric from the song? What do we think that means for the characters and how it sums up their overall journey?
Well, I suppose there's a significance for the fact that they're all perhaps, I don't know if they're all sort of running from something, but certainly they all kind of need to face up to things in one way or another, or need to address something in their life, you know. So certainly the way Antonio seems to be teaching his students is like encouraging creativity in them, that kind of thing. As you said, when you were talking about how he was absolutely fine with like being cheeked about what's your nickname, or is it Baldy or Fatty? You can see he's the kind of guy, the kind of teacher who like quite likes it when children are slightly cheeky. Like he likes them to be spirited, you know, and thinks that's a valuable thing. And so, you know, I imagine he is kind of teaching them that there is more to life than this, you know, keep your eyes open, always be open to change. And of course, it has particular relevance in a regime, an authoritarian regime like Franco's Spain. You know, you can spend your whole life in a regime like that where you kind of think, well, day to day, it's not that bad. You know, like, sure, there's certain things I can't do, but actually it could be worse, you know, and that's...
You sort of get comfortable with that idea if you turn a blind eye to what it actually means.
It's a normalization, isn't it? Like, you know, anything like that gets normalized to some degree after a while. You know, I imagine that like, if you live in North Korea, you don't live in a constant state of thinking this is terrible. This is an awful regime. What do I do to change this? Some people will, but the vast majority of people will just be getting on with their lives because that's what human beings do.
Yeah.
Just adapt to their circumstances and deal with it. So yeah, the line "living is easy with eyes closed" kind of has significance in that regard. In that maybe it's trying to say you can just get on with your life and never question or challenge anything around you. But it's good every once in a while to open up your eyes and see what there is you can change around you.
And I think that makes sense to me. I think where I, if I'm being honest, where I come unstuck a little bit in terms of interpreting that for the film is how that applies to each of the three main characters.
Yeah.
Because where I think the film ends up is with Franco getting picked up by his father and going home with him. Belen, I think the implication, like you said earlier, is that she will move on to Madrid, accept her pregnancy, have her child, and try to make that work.
Yeah.
And then you have this moment of sheer rebellion from Antonio, who gets his revenge on the bully that cut Franco's hair earlier.
Yeah.
And drives around his strawberry patch, ruining his crop whilst shouting help, which is just a glorious scene, because it's played quite clumsily as well, in a way that you expect, like a man like Antonio, his particular stature and you know his how he sort of squares up to a giant bully, how he would do, a little bit of cowardice involved, a little bit of like gumption, all of that. But those are three different, very different endings for each of those three characters. And I think where I become unstuck is, if I'm being generous, I would say that all three are confronting their own particular problems in different ways.
Yeah.
And that just confronting them in any way at all is representative of the kind of change that this film is suggesting needs to happen.
Yeah.
And that then chimes with the title. If I was being less generous, I would say those are three very different and potentially opposing ways to deal with change, and I'm not sure what the film is trying to say about any of them.
No, I suppose you know, something like this is bound to sort of paint with a slightly broad brush, I suppose. Mm. But certainly they're all kind of having to open their eyes in some way, I suppose.
Yes.
Or be encouraged to do so in order to face up to whatever challenges or defects they think they have. I mean, to be honest, like Antonio, probably the least of them. You know, he does seem... I mean, that scene squaring up to the bully is actually, yeah, not even played as any act of great catharsis, certainly not played as any act of great heroism, or like,
no.
Oh, this is a guy who is like used to be timid and now he isn't, you know. He says in it, you know, like, you can't live in fear. People in Spain live in fear a lot, and you can't do that. But I don't get the impression that Antonio is like forever changed and he goes away and he is now the cut. I get the impression he was always a guy who would square up to a bully, you know.
Yeah.
And this is just an example of it, as opposed to he is changed by his experience and now he has the courage to face up to this bully. I don't think it's that. So actually, I mean, Antonio in a way seems to be the one who has changed the least, if you ask me.
Yes, I agree. But he's also the one that's providing the lesson in some ways, isn't he? I think that's his role in this film, is what he imparts to his pupils explicitly within the lyrics of Beatles songs.
Yeah.
He's kind of imparting also to Belen and Juanco in this idea of encouraging them to affect that change for themselves.
Yeah.
And there is a brilliant quote that in his argument for why Beatles songs are so important, he does talk about them being life-changing songs.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of like a nice, neat sort of summary of how strongly his character feels about those songs and why those songs are important to him and therefore to us as an audience watching this film.
He does, because that quote is great, you know. And he says, to know that someone before you felt what you're feeling at this moment, you're no longer alone. We all need to shout help sometimes. And that's a lovely thing, this idea that perhaps didn't have that much currency at the time, that the pop music and the lyrics to pop music can sort of make you feel less isolated, can like connect you to the world, you know. Again, like, he doesn't seem to... You see a scene of him in his flat, like sort of cooking a meal for one in his saucepan. Yeah. Like, he can't get the stove to work, so he like turns the iron over.
Love that. And that's brilliant.
And puts the pan on top of the iron. But he doesn't seem like a lonely or unsatisfied guy in those scenes, because you could play, yes, that as like, oh, this guy lives in kind of squalor and he's given up on himself a bit, and I don't get that impression.
No, not at all. No, he's very happy. I think he seems to have found his place.
Yeah.
in imparting the teachings of the Beatles, yeah, through his lessons.
Yeah.
I think it's a nice place to be in. He's content with that. And yeah. I think that's what you get. It turns him into sort of a fun, charming, likable character.
Yeah.
But I think that's quite a nice guy to hang around with for 2 hours in this film, I think, isn't it?
Absolutely.
But we'd love to know what anybody else thinks. Have you just watched this film? And do you agree with us? If you've watched this film, do you need to know that we have felt like you are feeling now? You are not alone. If you need to shout help to anyone in particular, you can reach us on all the usual social media platforms at Beatles Films Pod. Also, feel free to leave us a review or a 5-star rating on your usual podcast listening platform of choice. Otherwise, we'll see you again for another episode next week. And until then, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.